And okay, before we start, or as we start, welcome everybody. I just want to thank our sponsors for this evening. This shiur is being sponsored in honor or in the observance of the upcoming Yahrzeit and Shushan Purim, Meir Kronenberg, Meir Ben Avraham, by his daughters Estella Berman, Sarah Avihar, and Lily Fetter, good friends of Torah Motion. I see some of them here online, and we should have long life and good memories and good occasions to come and join all together. Well, thank you. And Bakasha, Mark, it's all yours.
Yes, thank you. And like I said, I was in Florida, and it's always good to go down there. My parents live there, but also I meet people who actually listened to the classes, not live, but so that was sometimes people even stop me. They recognize me, so that's weird. But so that's good to be back. It's March 18th, class number two, the Musar dispute. And before I get into it, I just want to, there were some things that I wanted to get to last class. I was holding off. I didn't do it last class, but this is already from the previous semester. Just a few things I wanted to do from the previous semester. The other things, it's not really that important. I'll leave it. The first thing, the very last class, we were speaking about the minhag, the Kabbalistic minhag for children not to go to the funeral of parents, or actually of, I thought it was just of fathers. Correct me if I'm wrong. And I wasn't sure if it was daughters as well. And people said it is, and indeed it is. You can look in this volume. It's the memorial volume of Rabbi Yitzhak Nissen. Many, there's like six separate books. And one of them, volume six, is a whole book by his son, also Zichrono Livracha, Meir Ben Ayahu. And it's all about the Isser Liatzias HaBanim Acharei Mitas Avihem. So I wasn't sure whether Banim meant Banim and Banos. It does. But I'm pretty sure it only means fathers, because the whole idea is that those, the Zera that never became a child, that's the, they can go after you if you actually go to the cemetery. So a whole book this thick on that unusual practice. Okay, the second thing I want to share with you, I never got to it for some reason, and I think it's important to mention it, was with regard to repeating words in davening, because we've done so much on the Rav. And I did mention the Rav's position, but I didn't call attention to a letter he actually wrote in, it's public, it's Rabbi Rittenteru, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld. I'm sort of, I don't know if I'm related, but my son-in-law's sister married a grandson of Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld last year. So I'm really not related, but okay, I can say I'm sort of related through marriage. But he was very, very close to the Rav, very close Talmud and follower of the Rav. And after the Rav passed away, he published a number of letters that he received from the Rav. Incidentally, he didn't publish one letter, which I have, which I got subsequently to writing my article and subsequently to the talks. One of the family members sent me another letter because of the shiur and the 23 talks, 21 classes we had on the Rav. He sent me a letter that doesn't appear there from the Rav about Machitza. Very interesting formulation of the Rav about Machitza, because he says there's no actual, you can't actually give an exact height. You have to actually see it to determine it. I'll publish that in a future blog post, I think. So I thank him for sending that to me. But in this, in Hadarom is the rabbinic journal of the RCA, number 63 on page 27. The Rav answers Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, who was also a pulpit rabbi's question about repeating words. Actually, the letter has two things. The first part deals with, do you have to get married outside? Some people have this practice of marry under the stars. And I seem to recall certain places where they would open the roof up. And he says that Reb Chaim didn't pay attention to this. And He thinks that he remembers that Belville's marriage was inside, not out. And I haven't heard much recently about that, although I was at a Hasidic wedding a couple of years ago in Lakewood, and he actually went outside to do the chuppah. But other than that, I don't think I've ever. I've been to weddings outside, but I think it's more for because it's a beautiful setting and they like it. And I was at a wedding also. Rabbi Kellner was at a wedding also. Because of the rain, we had to move it indoors. They had to move it indoors. But in general, I don't know if people are mopping on that. So the Rav doesn't think it's a big deal. But then he asks, so what about repeating words? He says, Ani makpid me'od. He says, the Rav, he says, I'm very stringent on it that this Shliach Tzibor should not say any prayers. Words and prayers twice or three times. He says, though, that this only applies in Chazaras Hashatz, repeating Shemone Esrei, and in Brachos, Birchas of Shema, in Hallel, in Psukim of the Torah, of the Tanakh. Thinking that he says, even though these are not Chova, these Psukim, you still can't do it. So that would apply to also the end of Aleinu. You know, Vene, Mar, Vayashem, the Melchorts, Bayomahu, Bayomahu. You know, that's the Rav would have a problem with that. But he does say when it comes to piyutim and other matters that are not essential to the davening, and you're not quoting a pasuk, he doesn't have an issue with it. So that's relevant because in before when you take the Torah out of the Aron Kodesh, I've been to shuls now where they don't let you do the way you used to do it. Remember, we used to sing it, Be Anarachit, Velishme Kadisha, Kadisha, Yakira. Now they make you, they stretch it out. They don't let you repeat any words there. And the Rav's saying, well, not a problem. After all, what could be the problem? It's from the Zohar. There's no meaning that you don't repeat words from the Zohar. Now, we saw that Rav Moshe wasn't so makpid on it, and the Aruch HaShulchan wasn't as makpid if you're not messing up, as we say, the matbeah of the tefillah. But the Rav is very strict. You know, I recalled another example of this that because I want to read you something. Let me call your attention here to in davening. Anyone who's my age or older will remember this from Shabbos davening when we say in Musaf, what was it after Tikkun Shabbos? We say Yismachu B'machus. So growing up, you all heard this, and it's a Hasidish minhag. It's a Hasidish nigun. I don't know if the Hasidim still do it. One of our listeners could tell us. But we all grew up hearing this. Yismechu v'malachusecha, shomrei 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 Shabbos. Now, first of all, there's a repetition of Shabbos. Shomrei 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 Shabbos. Ramosha thinks technically it's not a problem in the Aruch Shulchan, but there is a problem because then you say v'kari oneg Shabbos, and that's not the order. The word Shabbos, as you see, does not appear at the end of, doesn't come after oneg. Doesn't say Kari Oneg Shabbos. That's what the Chazan added in. So that, according to Rav Moshe, would be absolutely not allowed. But that's what we all say. Okay. So why do I mention this? Because today, sometimes the people, they'll sing, they'll say it like, Yismechu v'malchusecha, Shomrei dai 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 Shabbos, or Shomrei Shabbos dai 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 dai, Kari Oneg dai dai dai, something like that. So, and you're not repeating words, so therefore it's okay. Well, I'm telling you, who says it's okay to do that? Look at the Aruch. You heard of the Chavos Yair? Rav Yair Chaim Bachrach? The great Chavos Yair, 17th century. The Sefer Chavos, that's named after his, although it's a pasuk, but it's named after his mother, Chava. If you look in his, he wrote a commentary on Shulchan Aruch. It was only published 2 generations ago. It's called Makor Chayim. And if you look in Or HaChaim, I printed out here, Siman Sadi Zion. It's page 41, Machon Yerushalayim printed it. He says that there's a terrible minhag that has come to Germany. You know where it came from? It came from Poland. All the bad minhagim come from Poland, he says. And what do they do? He said he talks about as the Chazanim, they do all sorts of bad things. But the one that I'm calling your attention to is that he says as follows. He says when they're davening, apparently they were mocked. They didn't want to repeat words. So he says that, first of all, they mess up the tenuot and et cetera. Then he says, while they're the Chazan, what does he says? He says, the Korin, dan, dan, la, la, the Chayotzebeela. So in other words, the Chavos Yair is saying, you can't say, Yismechu v'malchusacha, dai, 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 dai. He says, that's also wrong, because then you're just putting in filler. And therefore, so for the Chavos Yair, no la, la, no dai, dai, you know, if it doesn't work for the Nigun, if it doesn't work, in other words, if you want to use the old Nigun, but you don't want to repeat the words for the Chavos Yair, find a new Nigun. Because it's just, he makes it seem as if it's just as bad to repeat words as it is to throw in all that filler, di 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 di, because that's also not part of the davening. He says that he says it's terrible what these Chazanim are trying to do. And finally, I want to not that it's relevant per se with any particular class, but it's relevant to many classes we've done. We've spoken a lot about Jewish law, and we've spoken about Blue Greenberg's famous saying, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way, which I have made an addendum to it. When there's a rabbinic will, there sometimes is a halachic way. And we're going to see an example of this. It's, I believe it's incorrect to say there's always a halachic way. That doesn't work. But so there's an article here in the last Hamayan, which is Teves Tovshin Pei Dalet by Rav Shlomo Rafal Dachovsky. His name is Rav Shlomo Dachovsky. They added Rafal because he was ill. He's one of the great Dayanim. He was on the Beis Din HaGadol. You can't get bigger than the Beis Din HaGadol. That's the Supreme Rabbinic Court. The official name is Beis Din HaGadol Le'irurim, the appeals court, because the high court in Jerusalem is an appeals court. But all the greatest Rabbanim are on that court. Rav Avadya Yosef, Rav Yashiv was on it. That's like the top of the top. Then he became like head of the Beis Din. Now he's retired. So he has an article in here called Hir Horim Hilchotiyim Be'ikvot Melchamot Yisrael. You know, just thoughts about, you know, with the halachic thoughts that arose out of the wars of Israel. And he goes into all different tangents. But on page 69, he tells the following story. And I know, because I've heard people say that what I'm going to tell you now is conservative Judaism. It's not halachic. It's all this. And here you see one of the Gedolei Ador, Rav Dachovsky, he says it. So it's not me saying it. It's not Rabbi Kelman saying it. It's not anyone else. It's he saying it, but this is reality. And anyone who knows about Psak and has spoken to Poskim, you know this is real. He tells the following story. It's from his Sefer. He wrote a Sefer, Kfivan de Shevos and Chuvos, Lev Shomea. And he repeats what he wrote there in the introduction to one of the volumes. He quotes a story from Dr. Chana Katan. Chana Katan is married to Yoel Katan, who's the editor of this Hamayan. She's a gynecologist. She's American, actually. She's written a lot on maternity halachot. Rav Yoel Katan is at Shalvin. I don't think he's in yeshiva. I think he's in the high school there. Big, big Talmid Chacham from the family. Katan is Klein. His father, Moshe Klein, is the one who did the dictionary of Loze Rashi. That is all the Rashis that he cites, old French, because the family comes from France, originally from Germany, but through France. And he tells the following story that Dr. Katan told, that she was a young doctor, and she was doing her thing, you know, helping women give birth. And one of the Gedolim, he doesn't mention the name, one of the poskim in Jerusalem, must be from the Ida Haridit, he poskined that you couldn't use an epidural. It's usher. I don't know. I'd like to know what the reason is that he poskined that. What? Because the curse of Eve? Well, if that's the case, then we can't use tractors on our farms, because, you know, the men also have a curse. They can't bring forth their fruit, as it were. It's the same thing. The woman brings her fruit with pain, and the man has to bring forth the crops with pain. But whatever, this Posig Osser the epidural. So lo and behold, the daughter of this Posig was one of Dr. Katan's patients. And she was having terrible pains. And Dr. Katan suggested that she should do like everyone does, have an epidural. And she refused, saying that, Abba Shalala Masha, her father does not permit. But when the pain was getting much worse, Dr. Katan suggested to call and ask your father again. Maybe he can find a way to matter it. Maybe Yesh Makom Lahatir. And so they brought the telephone to her, and she called her father and spoke to him in Yiddish. That's why I say it's one of the Eda Charedit rabbis. And he listened on the phone to his suffering daughter. Dr. Katan said she didn't understand what was being said. She doesn't know Yiddish, but she did hear that the daughter was crying, Tata, Tata, Daddy, help me here. And when the conversation ended, Dr. Katan asked her, what did your father paskin? And she said, Mutter, Mutter. Now, Rav Duchovsky says as follows, Mikachlamad, from here we learn, ki kasher ponim el tata, that when you turn to tata, daddy, the very familiar here, not formal, not some stranger, but when a child turns to daddy with a problem, az lifamim gam pesikat halacha mishtaneh, so that sometimes mishtaneh, sometimes even the Psak halacha will change. So here you see one of the Gedolei Poskim saying that depending on who asks, if it was a stranger asking this posig, the psak would have been no epidural. It's his daughter, and he hears her. The subjective element enters, and that's the theme of the article, that subjectivity, how it enters into the halachic process. So we already saw the Rav last semester where he says that he's conscious of the subjectivity. And the Rav didn't say this, but at other times he could have said that he'll try to keep it at bay as much as he can. But in the case we saw, he didn't. He said that I'm going to try to matter. I want what Jews rabbis to be chaplains in the armed forces. So here you see one of the Gedolei HaPoskim saying, the whole article talking about how subjective factors can influence the halacha. In this case, it was his daughter saying, Tata, you got to find me a heter here. This is hurting me. And so I think that's very interesting. What can I say? There are certain writers in halacha who portray halacha as simply like a science. It goes in a computer and comes out when it's an art. And let's leave it at that. And now we go back, we take you back to Eastern Europe to this issue, the Musar dispute, which we're going to be focused on for so many weeks. Last class, we spoke a little bit about the really before the Musar dispute, some of the issues there. I mentioned in an offhand way that Mendel Leffen, the Maskil, he wrote a work which became very popular among the Musarniks. And I thought I said that it was an adaptation of Benjamin Franklin. If someone wrote to me that it's not a translation, I said translation's mistaken. It's an adaptation of something Benjamin Franklin wrote. In fact, there's a whole article here by Nancy Simkoff, who's a scholar of Eastern European Jewry. Benjamin Franklin in Jewish Eastern Europe, Cultural Appropriation in the Age of Enlightenment. And she talks about how Mendel Leffen used Benjamin Franklin's work to come up with a good Musar work. Okay, I want to now though return, pick up where we left off. If you remember the last thing we were dealing with, I gave you some examples how even with Rav Yisrael Salanter, they made troubles for him. They opposed him because they didn't like this idea of Musar he was spreading. We have to get into more detail today. What could they possibly not like? I have to tell you one more thing about Rav Yisrael Salanter, because generally Rav Yisrael Salanter was treated very well because he was known as a great tzaddik. The real issues, the real controversy, and when it gets really problematic, is after Rav Yisrael's death. But there is one other example that Katz mentions in Pulmos HaMusar, that in 1849, Rav Yisrael Salanter comes to Kovno. And the Rav at that time. His name was Rav Leibowitz Shapiro, no relation to me. He's known as one of the great Gaonim, Rav Leibowitz Shapiro. Wow. He's known for a number of things, but one thing he's famous for is there's a book called Todos Yerkovno, and it mentions this that there is a practice. We all have this minhag. We stand up for Aseres HaDibros. You stand up. It's one of the things you stand up for. This has been going on for over 1,000 years. We stand up. Lo and behold, in 1934, they published the response of the Rambam, where the Rambam says you're not supposed to stand up for it. This is often described as the Rambam saying, because we can't say that one section of the Torah is more important than another. But that's not what the Rambam says if you look to it. There are definitely sections of the Torah that are more important. The Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad is more important than knowing who Esau's concubine was. What the Rambam says, importance has to do with philosophical truth. What the Rambam, theological truth, what the Rambam says is that no section of the Torah is more sacred, holy, than another section. Sanctity has to do with revelation. Every part of the Torah, even the concubines of Esau, have the same holiness because they come from the same divine source. That's what the Rambam says. But no one knew about this for all these years, and no one knew about it, and no one listened to it. And when the Rambam's tshuva first came out, they asked Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe has a tshuva on it. He says, no, that's not our minhag. Everyone stood up for it. Rav Ovadia Yosef, however, a big follower of Rav Moshe, he, for whatever reason, decided that he has to make a stand on this, and he spoke about it, and he wrote about it, his response saying it's absolutely forbidden. And because of his influence, it then became popular that, in the Rambam's day, you sat down. You would sit, I guess, for everything. But they're not going to have you sit because everyone knows you stand. So today, in many shuls, they actually make an announcement, not every shul, in many shuls, you should stand up from the beginning of the Aliyah. And I ask people sometimes, why you make announcements stand at the beginning of the Aliyah? That's not Minhag Yisrael. Minhag Yisrael everywhere, Ashkenazic and Sephardic world, is only stand up for the Aseres HaDibros, not to stand from the beginning of the Aliyah. In fact, if you stand from the beginning of the Aliyah, you're defeating the whole purpose of the Minhag, because then you're not standing for Aseres HaDibros, you're standing for the whole Aliyah. That defeats the whole purpose. There's no reason to do it. But they always tell me, well, because you're not supposed to stand for the Aliyah. So I say, we're not supposed to stand. And either they don't know, or somebody say, the Rambam says, the Rambam says. Okay, the Rambam says. Yes, the Rambam says, but that's not Minhag Yisrael. Not everything the Rambam says we follow. And if you really want to follow the Rambam, then why would you stand from the beginning? Because they're standing dafka for the Aseres HaDibros. So in any event, although this year I was in a shul and they didn't announce from the beginning of the Aliyah. Everyone just did like everyone did for 1,000 years or more. Right before Aseres HaDibros, the guy gives the clap, and then we all stand up. Okay. However, Rav Leibowitz Shapiro, as far as I know, he's the only person in history to ever come up with this on his own. He, on his own, in Kovno, in the mid-19th century, abolished the practice of standing for Aseres HaDibros. That's what's recorded in the Sefer Todos Yerkovno, which I assume means you sit. Not that you stand for the beginning of the Aliyah, you sit, because Dafka, you're not supposed to show that any. I mean, look, if you always sit for Kriyas HaTorah and then you happen to stand up for the entire Aliyah of Aseres HaDibros, you also are violating the Rambam, because then you're saying that the whole Aliyah, not just Aseres HaDibros, this whole Aliyah is more sacred or of more importance than everything else. So the whole thing doesn't make sense, but you can't fight City Hall. What are you going to do? You can't. If once these minhags start taking off, you can't stop it. Not even 10 years ago, I think, the new minhag started. You'll see it this Shabbos, to stand up for Parsha Zachar. Never heard of such a minhag. All of a sudden, now everyone's standing up. What are you going to do? You're going to go back? In almost all your shuls, they're going to make you read the whole pasuk, unless you're Chabad. Chabad, you just read Zecher Zecher. That's my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, and I've read Parsha Zachar, even not a Bar Mitzvah, so I know. I was taught, you say, Timcha Ezecher Amalek, Ezecher Amalek. No whole pasuk. Now they're telling you have to repeat the whole pasuk. I mean, you can't change it. This has now become basically the minhag. So all sorts of interesting minhagim that just are developed. So this Rav Leibowitz Shapiro. It's recorded that he sent someone out to when Rabbi Shaul Salanter would give his drashas to challenge him, to dispute with him. And again, that's just an example, an early example, that even in Rabbi Shaul's lifetime, they knew that Rabbi Shaul was a tzaddik, but they didn't want him to be They didn't want him to be undisputed. They didn't want people to look at him like he's the Tzaddik Hador or the Gadol Hador. And therefore, if you send someone out to oppose him, so if he in his Talmudic discussion, someone asks shilas on him and kashas on him, people will look at him. They won't think that he's unquestioned. And therefore, if it's a dispute between Rishrael and another rabbi, he won't be one of the special ones that they can just listen to whatever he says, because they, Rav Leibel Shapiro, didn't like what Yisrael was preaching. But if you want to really see the beginnings of the Musar dispute, by which I mean rabbis attacking Musar in a widespread fashion, which then splits the Torah world, by which I mean the intellectual Torah world, then we have to look after Rav Yisrael's death, and really to the 1890s. Michelle died earlier than that. In fact, I was going to give you a date, but I can look it up rather than say today. Yeah, 1883. I was going to say 1881. So good thing I looked. Michelle died 1883. So what am I talking about? Well, we have to look to Slutsk. Slutsk is one of the great Torah cities in Lithuania. Last week, someone said Rav Aaron Kotler, Rosh Yeshiva of Slutsk, and I went along with it. And then someone pointed out correctly, he wasn't. He was never called that. He was called the Kletzker. Rav Aaron Kotler did come and work at the yeshiva, but it was always known as his father-in-law's yeshiva, versus Zalman Meltzer. When the yeshiva moved, because of the Soviets, the communists, to Kletzk, then he was known as the Kletzker. But this is before his time. Because there was a great rabbi in Slutsk. His name was Rav Yaakov David Walofsky. We know him as the Ridbaz, Resh Yud, not Radbaz, as it's often mistakenly written. That's Rav David and Zimra from Egypt, probably the last of the Rishonim. We're talking about the Ridbaz. I think let me get to take show you a picture of him as while we're speaking here. I might show you a picture of the great Ridbaz. We've had classes on the Ridbaz. His father's name was Zev. So Yaakov ben David Zev. Here, let me show you his picture face. Here you go. I pulled it on Wikipedia. So he was a great Talmud Chacham, the Ridbaz. We know him in particular for his Tshuvos and for his commentary on Yer Jerusalem Talmud. He comes to America. He ends up in Chicago for 2 years. The introduction to his Sefer, written, his Tshuvos deal with the issues in America. Fascinating, wonderful, wonderful Chiddushei Torah, one of the Gedolei HaDor. But I have to say, with no disrespect intended, controversy followed him wherever he went. And in fact, they say the story is, I don't know if it's true, but the story is because of his conflict with the Shoch team in Chicago, they actually locked him in the freezer and he could have died. And the story is that he told his family, we have to leave on Shabbos. They went on the train. I don't know if that's true, but he had lots of controversies. Everywhere he went, he had controversies. When he came to the land of Israel, he was told by the Rabbonim of Jerusalem that not to stay here in Jerusalem, but go to Tzfat. Why would anyone go to Tzfat? Who lives in Tzfat? You come, you go to Jerusalem if you're an old Rav. But they knew that wherever he went, trouble followed, so they sent him to Tzfat. That's the story that's recorded. He became Rav in Slutsk. Now, whether he's responsible for the controversy here, I don't know. But sometimes these Rabbonim, they are very adamant about their way, and l'shem shemayim. But it could create trouble. So he became Rav in Slutsk. And while he was there, he asks the Alter of Slobodka, Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel. He wants to open a yeshiva, and he asks Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, who's the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka. Slobodka is the great Musar yeshiva that was founded by Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, student of the students of Rishon Salanter, a yeshiva devoted to Musar, where not only will you study Talmud, but you'll also work on yourself from a moral perspective on your Yirat Shamayim. This isn't something that just comes naturally. There's something that you need to work on. A new position was created at the Musar yeshiva called the Mashgiach. We have a Mashgiach to make sure that the food is kosher. This Mashgiach has to make sure your soul is kosher. And this is a completely new, and so a whole new, approach, which we'll get into more detail as we go along. Musar, the Rav Shaul's perspectives brought to bear in the yeshiva, the great Sabotki yeshiva. So the Ritbaz asks him to send, asks the altar of Sabotka, that's his faith, it was known as the altar, the Saba. Today in Hebrew they call him the Saba, but in the old country it was called the altar of Sabotka in 1896 to send him not just students, but a Ram. That is someone to run the yeshiva. And Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who at this time was teaching in Sobotka, he agreed to go become the Ram, like the headman, and 14 students. 14 students come with the great Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer to Slutsk, to this new yeshiva. The 14 students became known as the Yad HaChazaka. Yad HaChazaka, Yad, Yodalit, 14. Just like the Mishnah Torah. The Rambam never named the Mishnah Torah Yad HaChazaka. People didn't like the fact that the Rambam called his great halachic work like the second Torah, the repetition of the Torah, Mishnah Torah. So instead they changed it to the Yad HaChazaka, which often we refer to it in shorthand as the Yad. But if you want to be a Maimonidean, if you really are a lover of the Rambam, don't call it the Yad, call it the Mishnah Torah. That's the name the Rambam gave it. The Yad HaChazaka was named by, to take away, not to use that name. But these 14 were known as the Yad HaChazaka. I want to read you the name of these 14 who came to Slutsk, and they're the ones who created all the problems. I mean, the Musar dispute begins in Slutsk because of the Yad HaChazaka who come. Now, how do we know who these 14 were? We know who these 14 were because of a very interesting book, Sefer. Here it is. All a Shame. Written, came out in Pinsk in 1912. The author's name is Shmuel Gottlieb. Look how thick it is. It's divided by country, every single country. He wrote to every rabbi in the world, and he must have had all sorts of people signed up for the book ahead of time to pay for all this postage, asking them to write back to him with their biographies. And some of them wrote back with very short notices, when I'm born, where I learned, where I'm rabbi of. Others wrote back with a whole page, their biography, where they learned, who they married, what their sfarim are. So you get all sorts of interesting information about the rabbanim, the American rabbanim, the whole section on America here as well. That's how I know who gave Rabbi Chaya Weinberg smicha. So a fascinating book here. By the way, for those of us who are Sephardim or those who use Sephardic pronunciation, I have to tell you how this book should be pronounced. And it's not pronounced, no one pronounces it this way in transliteration, but you listen to a Baal Kori, a Sephardic Baal Kori, this word, underneath the Aleph, it's a Kamatz Gadol. So, and underneath the Hay is a Kamatz Katan. It's actually, it's a Chataf Kamatz Katan. So it's actually pronounced, you know, because it's an Aleph, it's A. It's a Kamatz, it's already pronounced A. So it's Ahole. It's not Ohole. Ashkenazi, we pronounce basically Kamatz Gadol, Kamatz Katan, similar. Ole, something like that. But Sephardim have to pronounce this Ahole. And I went online today to see, well, is that really what the Sephardim do? And I listened to one of the big Balei Kriya from Jerusalem, Sephardic Balei Kriya. And indeed, that's how he pronounced it. Ahole. Ahole. So any of you, by the way, who adopt Sephardic pronunciation, that is, you say ah for a kamatz, and you say tu, not su, for a tough, and you don't have a soft, then you're, then that's how you should pronounce it. Although I'll give one caveat, because if you're an Israeli, we have a lot of Israelis listening to us, you speak modern Hebrew, or you're a Sephardi, your Seirei and your Segel are the same. So there's no Zecher Zecher repeating it, because basically they're all the same. There's only one. There's a Zecher. It's that Sefer. There's no Sefer. But if you're in America, even if you, maybe if you went to Flatbush, it's different. But all the people I know who have the Sephardic pronunciation, like my sons, they still pronounce Seire like an Ashkenazi differently. But you can't say Ohole. It's Ahole. For everyone who does that, the comments. In the pocket. Okay, let me read you from the Ohel Shem under the entry of Slutsk, page, well, he divides it into different sections, each on a different page. It begins who the rabbi is and tells the whole history of it. So here are the Talmidim, the Arah HaZaka. Some of them became great, great Torah scholars. One, Eliezer Yehuda Finkel. If you're in the yeshiva world, you don't call him Eliezer Yehuda Finkel. You call him Lazer Yudel. He's Lazer Yudel Finkel. We've spoken a good deal about him because in the classes on the Mir Yeshiva going to Shanghai. But Lazer Yudel Finkel, that's the son of the altar. Two, Rav Baruch Rabinovich, doesn't become famous. This is not the Baruch Rabinovich from Munkach, a different day from Tavrik. Three, Yitzhak Ziv, also from Tavrik, doesn't, they all became Rabbani, but never didn't become famous. The next is four, Yitzhak Rubinstein. He became the official rabbi, the crown rabbi of Vilna. You know, there are two rabbis in Vilna. And he was the crown rabbi. Then he was elected actually the actual rabbi. This was thought to be a great disgrace to Rav Chaim Moshe Grozinski, that the Mizrahi, when they, you're not supposed to have a Rav in Vilna. Since the Vilna Gaon, you're not supposed to have, since the Vilna Gaon's time, you're not supposed to be a Rav in Vilna, but they decided to have a Rav. And what happened was during World War I, Rav Chaim Moshe, he was the greatest Torah scholar, but he left, and Rabbi Rubinstein remained, and he was a big Talmid Chacham, as you can see, but he wasn't Rav Chaim Moshe's level, he was a big Talmid Chacham, but he did a lot for the people, and he was there for them, and therefore they wanted to reward him. When the idea came up, I don't know who came up with the idea first, if it was the semi-religious or the Mizrahi, to have once again to have a rabbi. The people wanted Rabbi Rubinstein. They had respect for Rav Chaim Moshe, but they wanted Rabbi Rubinstein as their Rav. Tzafes Chaim saw this as a great Chilul Hashem, the Mar Cheshes, Rav Chinuch Aigis, who was Mizrahi. And he was on Rav Chaim Moshe's base team. He resigned from Mizrahi over this because Mizrahi supported Rubinstein, who was a Mizrahi leader. So that's the politics of the rabbinate, but he was the official rabbi there. He escapes during the war, and he makes himself the way to New York, where for a short time he actually teaches at Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Hanun. So that's Rav Yitzchak Rubinstein. He's four. Five is Rav Yosef Konvitz. Rav Yosef Konvitz becomes a leader of a Buddhist rabbinate in America, the Rav of Newark, but he also becomes the son-in-law of the Ridbaz, and he's going to have a role in our story as well, as the son-in-law and as a Musar personality himself. Rav Yosef Konvitz, he wrote Shelos and Shuvos as well. Then six is Rav Lipman Rutskin, don't know anything about him. The seventh, his name is Lev Puchinsky. He was not famous, but he had a son, Rav Eliezer Puchinsky, who's a big Talmud Chacham in Yerushalayim, close to the Chazon Ish. The eighth is Rav Moshe Vachtfogel, not the household name. Ninth is Rav Moshe Hechtman, not a household name. Tenth is Rav Pesach Bruskin. He's better known. In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein studied under him. Rav Moshe Feinstein was in Yeshiva for a little bit, and he was in Rav Pesach Bruskin. Number 11, Rafal Halevi, Lobach, I don't know who he was. And 12th is Reuven Katz, the famous Degel Reuven of Petach Tikva. We've had classes on him. The 13th, his name is Shomos Henich of Dvinsk. Not important, well-known figure. And the last is someone named Mendel Luntz, who had already passed away by the time this was written. So these were the 14th. Okay, so here you have the Ritvaz bringing in 14 students with allegiance to the Musar yeshiva of Slobodka, adherents of Musar, and he creates his own yeshiva. Well, this creates a controversy. And for the first time in 1896, we have a Rav, a well-known Rav, coming out publicly. The very first article that ever appears in print against the Musar movements comes out of, against the Muslim movement, comes out of Slutsk and is a direct response to what I just described. Now, not surprisingly, this rabbi, and he's remembered for being the one to launch the first cannonball And he broke the ice, as it were. And people keep coming back to him because then he's attacked and he's defended. Well, who is this other? Well, there was another rabbi in Switzerland at the time. And I think we have to understand this whole controversy, the beginnings of it, in the context of this dispute. There was a rabbi. I always pronounce the name Feimer, Feimer, Feimer. Although Nussan Kamenetsky transliterates it as Pimer. I don't, maybe it is Pimer, but I'm not sure. The best way to, one of the times, the son of this rabbi we're speaking about actually ended up coming to America and died in Brooklyn. So I guess I tried to look online under Pimer and I couldn't find anything. I guess then you figure out how it is. But this rabbi, his name was Rav Meir, let's call him Feimer, Rav Meir Feimer. And he is a great opponent of the Ritbaz. There was a terrible dispute in Sutsk between the Ritbaz and Rav Meir Feimer. In fact, I have unpublished information, unpublished documents from the Feimer side in this controversy. I'm a little afraid to publish it because on the one hand, it's very eye-opening because it shows you what they were saying and what they were thinking. On the other hand, if I would publish this, here I'm publishing stuff attacking one of the Gedolei Yisrael. I have to find a way to publish this because I do want to write about this battle between them. Rav Meir Feimer. So where do they get to? How are there two rabbis in the city? You're supposed to only have one rabbi in a city. What's going on? Well, Rav Meir Feimer is the son of Rav Yosef Feimer. Yosef Feimer was the Rav in Sutsk for 35 years. One of the Gedolei Yisrael. His tshuvos have been published or republished by Machon Yerushalayim, recognized Gadol. He was succeeded by a name that many of you know. When Rav Yosef Feimer dies, the thinking was that his son will take over. That's how they did it in Eastern Europe. There was a lot of this nepotism that the son takes over. In fact, the rabbis often said that the son has a right to this position by Yerusha. Now you'd understand why the rabbis would say it. No one bothered asking the people. Your Rav Moshe has a tshuva that says it doesn't apply anymore today. Because when you hire people, you hire them for a limited time. There's no assumption that the son's going to take over. We don't have, but we have some dynasties in America as well. But that was common in Europe. But Rabbi Feimer, for whatever reason, is he remember when Rav Yosef died, his son Rav Meir Feimer didn't want the position. He was at the time serving as a rav in another city called Berezin, and whatever, he didn't want to come back there. So you know who becomes the rav? The Beis HaLevi, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, the namesake of the rav. This is the famous Beis HaLevi, the father of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Brisker. So you're talking about the great rabbinic dynasty. He becomes rav in Sutsk. Now, the Beis HaLevi, he wasn't, he was rough there, and then there were problems in Sutsk with the Balabatim, as was always the case. He goes to Warsaw, he's in Warsaw for I think it's 4 years, and then a new position opens up for the Beis HaLevi in Brisk, Brest-Litovsk, the rav of Brisk, his name was Rav Shulev Diskin, he goes on Aliyah. So Beis HaLevi becomes Rav in Brisk, and so begins the Brisker dynasty. Okay, so Rav Meir comes back. Rav Meir Feimer comes back to Sutsk after the Beis HaLevi leaves. The story is that the Beis HaLevi said Rav Meir Feimer should be the Rav. He didn't want to be it, so the Beis HaLevi came. When the Beis HaLevi leaves, Rav Meir Feimer comes and succeeds his father. And then mysteriously, after not that long, Rav Meir Feimer announces that I'm resigning. I'm resigning from Sutsk. I'm going to become a businessman. Pretty unheard of. You have a position, a nice position like that, to resign, although the Beis HaLevi resigned. So, I mean, it happens, but he resigns. Why did he resign? We have two different versions of the story. One version is that his daughter became irreligious. This is an era when many people became irreligious in Lithuania, many of the young, not just Lithuania, in Poland as well. But I do have to say, I'm going to write about this because I don't know how many of you listen to David Westenstein's show. I'm in the car a lot. I listen to it. Some of them I listen to. They're interesting. But he has said on numerous occasions, including last week, he says, and I emailed him and I said, it's not true, but he continues saying it. I guess it's one of the pieces of information he has in his mind that keeps coming out. He's saying that 95% of Lithuania were fry. That's the word he uses, fry, irreligious. 95% were Mechallel Shabbos. It's not true. I'll grant you that the Hasidim were better at keeping the people maybe than the Litvaks. That although there's plenty of people who have to fold in the Hasidic world also, but 95%, no, that's not true. Look, we have statistics. How do we have statistics? Because we know the Orthodox parties. That's the best way you can decide these things is look at the various elections. We assume that Mechallel Shabbos are not voting for Agudas Yisrael, that sort of thing. Even if maybe you have some nostalgia. But on the other hand, we know that there are people who are religious who would vote for general parties. So the idea that 95% of Lithuania were irreligious, it's not true. But there were plenty of people who became irreligious. Was it 50%, 60%? We have to figure out how we can come to estimates. So there's been some deal in Poland also. People have written on this, how to figure out exactly Gershom Bacon and others' calculations. Gershom Bacon thinks that up until World War I, the majority of Polish Jewry was Shomer Shabbos. Now, because you can't look at a city. Cities, you have the villages remain traditional much longer. I heard from Rav Golevsky, who was the Rav of, who was the grandson of Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger, the Dayan of Brisk. And he grew up in Brisk. He said that in his youth, there was only one store that was Mechallel Shabbos but for Hesia. That doesn't mean everyone was so medaktik on mitzvos, but only one guy was willing to do it publicly. And so in the smaller towns, people kept the tradition much longer. Okay, so the story is that Rav Meir Feimer thought, this is what Rav Yitzhak Nissenbaum, the great preacher, Mizrahi preacher, writes in one of his books, that Rav Feimer thought that if he could not be the Rav of Sotsk when one of his own children was irreligious, how could he preach to the community when in his own house, look what happened. So he thought there was only two choices. Either he'd have to kick his daughter out of the house or he'd have to resign. And he resigned. That in and of itself, Nelson Kamenetsky in his book, Making of a Godel, he mentions this. He says that's an example of a Musar person, even though he's an anti-Musar person, that he's not turning his back on his daughter. He resigns rather than having to kick his daughter out of the house. This was an issue in those days, but there were many. I don't know if it's true, the story. It's an interesting story he tells because there's plenty of rabbani whose children were irreligious. Although the truth is, they probably kicked their kids out of the house. It's only in the last generation that you find now in the most Haredi world, because every house, basically, or every other house, you have someone who's irreligious, that they have a much more open attitude. There was a time when they wouldn't have this. So much so that I've shown you in previous classes, they went to Rav Epstein and they asked him questions there. What to do if a boy comes home? He wants to come over Shabbos with his girlfriend. So Edelstein says, fine, fine. What about putting him in the same room? He says, fine, fine. It's not your problem. So here you have, it's amazing. And a Haredi run in B'nai Brak, the irreligious son is going to come home with his girlfriend and you're going to give them a bedroom together. And I mean, if you would have said 30 years ago, 20 years ago, that the leader of the Haredi world would give that as advice, that, you know, you can't lose the ties, we have to keep them close, people would think you're crazy. So now we have in the most frum world, we have people with children who are intermarried. So, you know, they still come visit. It's a different world. But this is all 130 years ago. And that's one version of the story. And even if it's not true, the fact that Rabbi Nissenbaum records it shows that it was a possibility, it was an issue. And I have to say that most of the children of Rabbani who became irreligious, they did not remain at home, at least based on what I have been able to determine. Because, you know, what would they want to live at home? How can they be who they are living in the house of the rabbi? So by mutual agreement, I guess, they would leave. Rav Kook has a letter to someone about this, to a rabbi, Milstein was his name, about this very issue, what to do about his children who are irreligious. There's another version of the story that Mayor Fimer resigned because the community was corrupt and financially and the leadership, and he couldn't deal with that. Be that as it may, he leaves the Rabbonus, and in Sotsk, he becomes Rav in a couple of cities, and then he returns to Sotsk. He returns to Sotsk in 1895 as a layperson, a balabas, a business person. It was not long before he has his own following. Lots of people in the town, they liked him. They knew about his father. They remember him, and he begins to have a following. And they see him as the real Rav of the community, not the Ritbaz. In fact, his son, who's named also named Yosef, sets himself up. He's set up as a Rav in a shul, and he starts his own yeshiva. So here you have the official Rav of the community, the Ritbaz, and then you have Rav Meir Fimer as the unofficial Rav for a part of the community. The Maskilim, by the way, all went to Rav Meir Fimer, and his son has his own yeshiva. Rav Henkin, the great Rav Yosef Eli Henkin, was in Sotsk at this time at the Ritbaz's yeshiva. Sorry, yeah, the Ritbaz's yeshiva, Rav Yisrael Meltzer's yeshiva. The Ritbaz was the rabbi, but Rav Yisrael Meltzer was running it. In fact, Rav Henkin got smicha from the Ritbaz, one of his smichas. He says, though, that the Ritbaz never tested him. His son-in-law, Rav Yosef Konvitz, tested him, and then the Ritbaz wrote the smicha. But Rav Henkin says that the reason the students went to the new yeshiva from Rav Yosef Fimer is because Rav Yisrael Meltzer's yeshiva was very strict, no secular studies. They were not even allowed to read the newspaper. And this is a oppressive environment, I think many people think. So they went to this new yeshiva, which didn't last that long. The Ritbaz was a kanon. So it's understandable. He was an extremist. It's understandable that many people would not be comfortable with that sort of rav. The Ritbaz famously said, if you hear an English language sermon, get up and walk out. Only Yiddish. I said before, I have a friend who leaves during sermons, and if people ask him why, he says, because I hold like the Ritbaz. If it's not in Yiddish, I don't want to hear it. Obviously, this is then going to create a controversy. You have two rabbis in the community, and the Ritbaz is one who's a Kanai. This is going to be a problem, obviously. In fact, according to Nissenbaum, the people asked Rav Meir Fimer to return to Sotsk precisely because they were not happy with the Ritbaz. Now, when I say that Ritbaz was a Kanai, I don't mean it. This isn't my judgment. The Ritbaz himself writes as follows in the introduction to a Shelos and Shubos. Listen to what he writes. You can find it on page 10 in the new edition of the Beit Ritbaz, Beis Ritbaz, published from sort of a quote. The Ritbaz tells us that he's saying, I am a Kanai, I've always been a Kanai. Who says being a Kanai is a negative thing? The Chazon Ish writes about how Kanaos is a positive trait. It all depends who's the Kanai. It's been suggested that the reason for bringing in the Yad HaChazaka, the Musar students, to the yeshiva in Sotsk was actually to strengthen the Ritbaz's position. Here you have, they come in 1897, they brought in. 1895, Yosef Fimer comes, creates controversy. You bring in a yeshiva to better establish his position. Now, Rav Nosson Kamenetsky doesn't like this, doesn't agree with this. And he says in Making of a Gadol, I have a PDF if anyone wants. We're going to return to Making of a Gadol a number of times. I have Making of a Gadol, the original, and I have the new, improved edition, which is the new, worse edition because it was a censored edition. It's the unfortunate thing, and I told this to Rav Nosson Kamenetsky. I wrote an article here 2 years ago in the Jewish Review of Books. They asked me to write it, Making of a Gadol, a 20-year retrospective. So you can read my original article on Making of a Gadol, which I wrote when it came out in 2003, I think it was. Yeah. My article was 2003, I believe. It came out 2002. Or you can read 2022, my retrospective. I told Rav Nosson Kamenetsky he made a mistake. He doesn't identify all the people in this picture, in the pages. This incidentally is the altar of Slobodka, if you can see. And but he doesn't show you. This is Revarman Cutler, looking very dapper as a young Bacher, but he wouldn't. He didn't want to identify in some of these pictures. In any event, why is there nothing like this? Oh, I see it's right at 9:25. So what I need to do still is tell you what's going to tell you where Nelson Kamenetsky says why he doesn't agree with that, as the reason this is also, I said, we're not just doing the dispute. You're going to learn all about all these Gedolim. And then we're going to see Rav Meir Fleimer's attack. What does Rav Meir, how does he launch this attack on the Mussar movement? The craziest thing he says. And then really we're going to be on a roll, because for every attack on the Mussar movement, you're going to have defense on the Mussar movement. And what begins in Slutsk then spreads all throughout Eastern Europe, and then it enters the sacred walls of the yeshiva itself, even the sacred walls of the Sobotka yeshiva, the Mussar yeshiva, the Altar's yeshiva. This the conflict is going to enter everywhere. And I think what our challenge is going to be is, because we're dealing with Gedolei Yisrael here, to try to at least appreciate what the great fear was and why these Gedolim and so many of the Gedolim had a problem with Mussar. And along the way, we're going to learn all sorts of history. In fact, next class, I'll even introduce you to Gwyneth Paltrow and what her family's role is in this whole saga. Or actually not in the saga, it just so happens that one of her family members, her sefer, is printed together with someone who has a central role in this saga. But time is already late, so let me make a note here on my notes where we left off. I hope you're ready to be brought back into, sometimes I think I was born in the wrong century. I should have been ni late 19th century Lithuania, because that's what most of my day is spent in. But okay, let's see the questions and comments. Mel says that many wedding halls have a skylight over the chuppah. Yeah, I've heard that, but I can't remember ever being in a wedding where they open up the skylight. People are machped not weddings in a shul. I've been to weddings where they do it outside, but other than one in Lakewood, I don't know if people do it outside for any reason.
Mark, I'm pretty sure even at the Beit in Toronto, the big shul in Toronto, there is a skylight in the hut. Pavel is shaking his head. And getting married outside in the shul, which is normal, and in the hall of the shul, which has a skylight. And I've been to plenty of weddings at the Beit where people get married in the hall because they want that skylight. I think it's more common than you think, people insisting on outside weddings. But anyways, okay, just, I'm
But
sorry.
I don't know. Does anyone know the reason for it? I know the reason why I'm not married in shul.
Under
I
the
don't know the
stars,
reason.
it's you're getting married under the stars. It's a bracha like by Avraham Avinu, Zarach. Yes, I think there's the idea of bracha. So kind of there's also a minhag. I don't think anybody follows this anymore. To get married only in the first half of the month as the moon is growing, like until kids.
There was minhagim of days to get married, but
On
now it's hard enough
Tuesdays,
to get a
it
hall
goes right.
sometimes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay.
The Rav says the Rabbi Kelman says the Rav also had a problem with the congregation singing with the Chaz and the Chazaras Hashatz. That is, all the singing we do on Yom Kippur Piyutim was not allowed in his minyan. In Germany, you would not sing along with the chazan, and the choir wouldn't even sing in Kedusha. There are certain times when you take the Torah to the Ark, the choir sings and the people can sing, but not during Kedusha. But for Piyutim in Shmoneh Esrei, that was never an issue for them. I don't know, what would be the problem singing along with
No,
the
like
chazan and the
Chazan, you can't sing that
You
because
know,
the Chazan,
why does the Rav have an issue with that?
because the Chazan has to do the Chazar Hashatz, only the Chazan, and Trei Kolei Lo Mishtai, two voices can't. So the Rav is very machmir. I know from people who tell him, I would hate it.
Yeah, but you gotta, maybe you could say that people sing low, but then some people are
I
gonna
know
be
I was
very
never
loud.
there, but this is what I hear from a lot of people. The Rav, anybody ever
Yeah.
in Brooklyn in the Rav's
You know,
minyan?
we spoke last class. Most people would say, what's the difference? Where no one's being Yotze with it anyway, all that. But as we saw last semester, the Rav holds that Chazaras Hashatz is actually a Kima mitzvah.
Correct. It's
So it's not
Tfilat
some,
Hatzibur. It's Tfilat
yeah,
Hatzibur.
so it says, so there's some, okay, it's interesting. And Nikki says, until today, the Chevra Kadisha, the Belgian community, will not allow women at any burial, and even the mother's burial. Okay, that's of interest. Ben from Israel wrote me, because we also spoke about women speaking, that today it's very common in religious Zionist circles for women to speak, including in somewhat Hardali places. Yes, so Moshe points out Rafal Shapira Volozhin, so his father is of Rav Leibel, of Kovno, but that's again no relation to me. Rav Shmuel Shapiro is the father-in-law of Rav Chaim Brisker. And it says in Moshe, you say that in the Toldos, you I gave the wrong name of it. Toldos Yehudim b'Kovno, he sat for Kriyas HaTorah. He sat for all Kriyas HaTorah, you're saying. Yeah. Well, in Lithuania, as far as I know, they sat for Kriyas HaTorah, but I heard from someone who was in Sabotka. When I was young, I had a Sabotka person in my shul. He told me that they would stand for Kriyas HaTorah. I don't have the book handy to look at. And you say that the Shlo in Shavuos writes to stand by the Merkava in Yeheskel on Shavuos. So that I didn't know. We also stand for Oz Yashir. I would consider the Radbaz, I think, the last of the Rishonim. Not the first of the Achronim. He's before the Achronim. He's the Achronim really starts at post Shulchan Aruch. Maybe the Shulchan Aruch is maybe the Achronim. Shulchan Aruch is the middle. I think the Radbaz, we have to consider him the last of the Rishonim. Now, this is, I think, could be relevant to Halacha, because if you're one of these people who adopts the position of Halacha Kabasarai, if the Radbaz is in the Rishonim, then maybe he could trump another Rishon. But I think we have to distinguish. There's the late Rishonim and the early Rishonim. The Radbaz is not a Rishon like Rashi or the Rambam. He's a Rishon maybe like the Tashbetz is a Rishon, the later Rishonim. That's my point. Mel says, in my minyan, we stand for the whole Aliyah of Aseres Dibros and the Shira and Chazak, because it's disruptive and noisy when people stand up in the middle of the Aliyah. I don't know what you mean when you say you stand for Chazak. I mean, you stand for the whole Aliyah of Chazak. Okay, this I've never seen before, but I'd be curious now how long they've been standing for the whole Aliyah, because I wonder of Aseres Dibros, if my sense from being around Pisces is that they started standing for the beginning because of the Rambam's position, even though, like I said, it was universal. As far as I know, it was universal just to stand for standing for the Aliyah, standing for Chazak. Okay, well, that's that I've never heard of, but it makes sense. I want to tell you something about, since you mentioned that, hold on a second, because we just did Chazak, Chazak. Yes, okay, and I got it. Okay, I'm going to show you something now, which again, will never take off. No one's ever going to follow this. I'm going to pull it up on my screen here for you, but I'll pull it up in a second. Hold on, Shmuel Bays. But you can impress people next time. I just thought of this because of what Mel said. Oh, you can't see the screen here. Let me show you my screen. Okay. Hold on a second. I gotta find it here. I know it's in this. Yes. Okay. You see everyone here? What does the pasuk say in Shmuel? Chazak v'nischazak v'adamenu. So you see from this that we shouldn't be saying chazak chazak v'nischazek. You should be saying chazak chazak v'nischazak. That in biblical Hebrew, it's nitzchazek. So what are you going to do? You can't change it. You're never going to change it. But if you want the proof that really it's supposed to be pronounced nitzchazak, not nitzchazek, now why is it? I don't know. We have these exceptions sometimes. You'd expect it to be a seiri. It's a patach back and forth. But here you see explicitly. You can't get any better than this. That it should be chazak chazak v'nitzchazak. But you'll have as much luck with that as you will in Yadid Nefesh by saying Tisalam instead of Tisalem, even though you can look there, it's a clear rhyme. It has to be Tisalam. But as I said, there's no pausal in modern Hebrew. There's no such thing as a pausal. So it's Tisalem, even though none of the sitters say they all get that right. So there it is. Thank you, Mel. Moshe says controversy followed his son over by convents. That's a different controversy. There was another Rav in Newark named Rabbi Mendelssohn. He was the Rebbe, by the way, of Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz. And he was also a Rav in Newark. And the conflict between Rabbi Mendelssohn and Rabbi Konvitz, but isn't that our Masorah? What did Yishai Leibovitz say? Yishai Leibovitz said that we know Chazal had a sense of humor because they say, Talmidei Chachamim, Marbim Shalom Olam. Scholars create peace in the world. And when we look around, we see that on the contrary. Lots of rabbis usually creates machokas. But both of them, Rabbi Konvitz, and I know them both, and I love them both because I'm writing my book. I'm trying to write it. Too many other things take up my time, but my book on halachic history of America, and each one of them, you want to know how they dealt with Shabbos violation during this era between World War I and World War II. They were leading poskim. They wrote Shalos and Shuvos. So you get a real sense of the community by reading their writings. But that was the dispute that we're going to talk about was at least ostensibly an ideological dispute. The dispute between Rabbi Mendelssohn and Rabbi Konvitz was a typical rabbinic dispute. It was the same. It was just, it was in localized, the same dispute between Agudas HaRabbonim and other. There was two other rabbinic organizations. There was Degel HaRabbonim, and there was another rabbinic organization. Not all the rabbis got along, just like they don't get along today. And those were two really gedolim, great poskim, and they didn't get along, just like lots of rabbis didn't join Agudas Rabbani. But that's a different issue. Yes, Paul, you are correct. The Ridvaz was an ancestor of
Miriam, not Esther. Her name was Miriam.
It was the Ridvaz was there was the father-in-law. It wasn't the Ridvaz, but the grandfather-in-law, I think, of Chesed Abramsky, right? I believe was the Ridvaz. I'm confused now. I have to check it. But definitely, Rabbi Abramsky becomes Rav in Slutsk. They're definitely related. Ridvaz has a number of descendants.
Her name was Miriam, not Esther.
What is it? It's the grand. Am I wrong here? Is it? I can't look it up now. Is the Ridvaz the grandfather-in-law of Rabbi Abramsky? Is that correct? I believe so. I'll check it for next class. Someone privately asked me, I said, Rabbi Rabinovich, I don't know who he is that the son of Yitzhak Chana? No, the son of Yitzhak Chana is Tzvi Rabinowitz. He is going to play a central role in our story also, not surprisingly, as an anti-Musar person. And then I'll explain to you, how is it that the son of Yitzhak Chana Spector happens to be named Tzvi Rabinowitz? Whatever happened to Spector? And privately, someone points out, Ray Paczynski, yes, was the son-in-law of the Altar of Slobodka. Yes. The Altar of Slobodka had many children. Go on Wikipedia, look at the entry. You'll see he has children, he has sons, and he has, daughters who married big Rabboni. He has one son, who they don't talk about, although, Kamenetsky speaks about it, but he became irreligious. He came to America, did his thing. Mel says in the Simonim Tikkun, a Kamatz Katan is printed only differently than a Kamatz Gadol. Indeed, and if you look every time that word tense, OLA, is mentioned, you will see that the under the hay, it's the Kamatz Katan. And Moshe says, he thinks Moshe Wachtfagel was Rodosa Wachtfagel, Lakewood's father. Could be, and you say it's Feimer, not Pimer. That's what I always thought, Moshe. I see you know a lot about Lithuanian rabbinic history, so I thank you for agreeing with me, because Nelson Kamenetsky, who knew, I think it's fair to say, knew more, at least he knew more than me. I don't know if he knew more than you, but he certainly knew more than me. He said Pimer. And now Nelson Wachtfogel from Lakewood, who also was from Yeshivas Rav Yitzchok Chana. We also have someone here who knows a lot about, tells me that Rafal of Lubetsch was Rafal Alter Shmulevitz, son-in-law of the Alter Navarra and father of Chaim Shmulevitz. I did not know that. So thank you very much. Yaakov Sasson says that most Faradim sat during the reading of the Ten Commandments based on the Ari, even prior to Ravad Yosef's campaign. That is news to me, Yaakov, because I never heard the Ari say that, and Ravavadya doesn't quote the Ari as saying that. So I think we need to investigate this, because Rav Avadya does not quote the Ari, as far as I recall, in his Chuv and Yechavadas as saying that. So someone says that he recalls me saying Reb Chaim was the only gadol who all the kids remained observant. I don't know if he's the only gadol, but he stands out. If you look at Rav Soloveitcher's contemporaries, it's impossible really to find someone whose all the siblings remained religious. Rav Chaim had five children, and they all remained religious, which is quite... Okay, a few more questions, comments. Moshe says, it's an interesting note to Ridbaz, who brought in the Musar students, was against the methodology of Chaim Brisker, who was also against Musar. Yes. Although I have to say that, look, I've spoken a good deal about the Ridbaz and the Briskers. I can now reveal something I didn't reveal before. I told the story. I didn't tell you who told it to me. Here's the story, which I told. One of the students of Soloveitchik cites the Ridbaz, and the Rav tells him, Rav Soloveitchik, don't mention him. And the student mentions him again, and the Rav goes crazy, screaming, as the Rav was wont to do in the 50s. And the Rav screams, some Gedolim are always right. Some Gedolim are sometimes right, and some Gedolim are never right. The Ridbaz was never right. I heard this from an eyewitness, Rav Zvulun Charan. I didn't want to mention who told it to me, because he might have not wanted me to repeat it. In fact, he actually told me not to repeat it, so maybe I shouldn't have. But I told him, I think I said to, I might have said to him that I told it without mentioning by name. He's the one who told it to me. And the Briskers always assumed that the comments of the Ridbaz in the introduction against the chemistry was directed, and I believe it is directed against the Briskers. It's not directed against Rav Rinus. He mentions this new method in Lita, but he also mentions the new method in Zamut. Zamut is an area of Lithuania, and this area of Lithuania, Zamut, includes Tells. He doesn't only attack the people in Lithuania, the Rosh Hashiva with chemistry. He says it's better to have no Rosh Hashiva than to have such a Rosh Hashiva. He also attacks the chemists in Zamut. Zamut is Tells. Zamut is Rosh Hashiva. So I think we need to be clear that when the Ridbaz attacks the methodology, the new Lundus, the Lundus that the Beis Halevi said, I was born before Matan Torah, because now you have new giving of the Torah, I think we have to conclude that the Ridbaz is not just attacking the Briskers, he's attacking Rav Shimon. Rav Shimon Shkop, who had his own method, which created controversy. Okay, I think I could go on. We're having lots of fun here, I see, and many comments. I don't want to go much. I'm going to copy all these comments here, and I'm going to send them to myself, and I'll get back to some of them.
Rabbi Shapiro.
Next class, maybe, but we've. I don't want to keep people too much longer. Just one a final comment. Someone's talking.
Minak Frankfurt today is Minak Hazak Venis Hazak.
So who says that?
Naftali.
Naftali, yeah, but you're saying in Washington Heights they say Nis Hazak?
In Bnei Brak, in all the. Yes. Rabbi
okay,
Hamburger.
Where Rabbi Hamburger. Yes.
Rabbi Hamburger brings it down in the.
Oh, I didn't know that. But when you say Bnei Brak, you don't mean a Litvish yeshiva.
The Ashkenaz shul Bnei Brak, the Ashkenaz shul that's in.
Okay. That's Mishlata. That's Ashkenaz. So the old German minhag. So it's. I thank you for repeating that, reporting that. That the old German minhag remains of Nischazak. I assume
words.
That there
and
was a time
words.
When everyone said Nischazak. How about Yaakov Sasson? And what did the Sfaradim do? They say, but you know what? We've all been influenced by modern Hebrew. But the Germans hold on to them and hug him like almost no one else, them and the Yemenites. But thank you for pointing that out. And I'll pick up with some of these comments that I don't want to keep us too long, though. Thank you all. I hope you're having fun. I hope... Look, for some people, we're going too much in the weeds, and we're picking up and landing in the middle of Lita, you know, the center of Torah Judaism. But for those who like this sort of thing, we're going to have lots of fun. So I appreciate it, and I see we already have a lot of learned people here, some of whose names I even mentioned. So shkoyach to you all, and God will see you next week. Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Thank you very much. Okay, you could go on a few more minutes. I wouldn't object, but okay, I get it.
Okay, whatever. I stopped. I'm going to begin with some of these comments.
Yeah, of course.
I'll begin with the comments. I copied them all to myself.
Yeah. Okay. We look forward to our regular schedule throughout the remainder of the week. And Of course, next Sunday we won't have our regular Shirim because of Purim, but Shushan Purim, well, Monday night will be Shushan Purim. That 8:30 will not be after night, but that we'll see you next week, of course, the after Purim. Okay, everybody be well. B'sorot Tova, thank you again for sponsoring in memory of your father, Lily, and Estella, and Sarah. Thank you, and we should have good occasions to celebrate. Okay, everybody be well. Laila Tov, and we look forward to learning with you soon. I invite a friend to join us. Laila Tov. Okay, thank you.